And welcome once again to a WaitingForNextYear.com podcast. This time we're switching it up yet again. I've got Andrew on the Subway Fresh Take hotline. I figure if I say that, maybe and send an invoice, we can get paid.
Do we have to talk about what the weather is like here too to get that perfect setup?
Well, how is it in Columbus right now?
It's a little dark out, but kind of turned into a gloomy evening.
Yeah, well, and that's probably pretty telling, as everybody except us right now is watching Browns in 95.
Yeah, tell me about it.
So let's start there. You said you weren't going to watch it.
Yeah. I don't know. For me, I guess I don't feel that that's anything I need to really dig back into. It's certainly one of the most painful sports things that that I've ever gone through. And to reminisce and think back on it, I don't know. I guess I don't feel the need to do that. I kind of feel like, you know, I've moved on and I'm focused on what the Browns are now, and looking back at that era just doesn't appeal to me in any way. And I'm also skeptical of the way that that it's going to come across as well. I think I'm a little worried about that. So in general, I just don't think that it was something that I was really interested in watching. But I think you were coming from it from a little bit of a different point of view, I guess, than from what I was looking at it as. I think you were looking at it as sort of a behind-the-scenes look of what really went down. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you know, it's. I think the NFL, from the fan perspective, has changed so much since 95, at least, and probably even in the last few years, where the inside access, the behind-the-scenes access, the coverage, everything from fantasy and knowing players and being on Twitter with players, it's all changed so much. And I kind of feel like I missed out on all that kind of behind the scenes stuff. And now I'm going to get a glimpse at it back from 95. And I honestly don't remember a lot about Bill Belichick, other than the fact that I didn't like him because they didn't win a lot and he cut Bernie Kosar. But I don't remember having the same kind of knowledge or relationship as a fan with Bill Belichick as I did with, say, any of the new coaches, from, you know, Romeo Crennel to Eric Mangini, where I really felt like I knew those guys and I listened to every word they said. Belichick as a Cleveland coach is almost like an enigma to me. I didn't like him, but it's kind of reflexive at this point. I don't even, you know, I couldn't tell you game to game why that is.
Well, that's kind of interesting. And I think, too, I also kind of wonder, I find it interesting that you mentioned, you know, Romeo Crennel and not Chris Palmer. I don't mean to get too far off the subject here, but I was kind of thinking about it when we mentioned, you know, you and I are the same age for the most part, and we sort of look back on that differently. And I wonder if, so the Browns left in, you know, 95, and when they came back in 99, you were in Boston then, is that correct?
Oh, yeah, I was in Boston, and when I wasn't, you know, sneaking into sports bars, I was listening to Jim Donovan make the calls online. So my relationship with the Browns in 99 was pretty weird, too.
Yeah, so I just kind of thought that was kind of interesting. I wonder if that put a little bit of distance between you and the Browns coming back in 99, being so far. Now, you know, I was in Columbus at the time, not Cleveland. I don't live in Cleveland. I've actually never lived in Cleveland. So it's not to say that if you're not in that city that, it, you know, you didn't experience it at all. But I just, in terms of sort of that disconnect, and maybe that's even the wrong word, but just sort of how we view the events of the Browns leaving. There was that 3-year absence. And when they came back, you were in, you know, a totally different state. Pretty far away. And I just wonder if that is part of why we look at this sort of differently as well. It's just kind of interesting to think about.
No, that's for sure. Because I was sitting on my couch by myself watching the Browns get pounded by Pittsburgh on their welcome back foray into the NFL. And then on top of that, I felt lucky at the time because I had my first DSL modem, and Cleveland.com was really kind of coming into their own. I think they just celebrated 20 years, and that was 17 years ago. So all things considered, you know, I didn't have to go across the river to Cambridge to get an out-of-town paper on Sunday to get the Cleveland Perspective. And so, you know, but compared to today, I mean, it's the Dark Ages.
Right. And I think that's the big difference is while, excuse me, at that time, you know, you certainly viewed it as, well, I've got, you know, this new thing, relatively new thing, the internet at my fingertips. The pervasiveness of coverage wasn't even remotely the same as what you get today. I think today it makes it much easier for people to be very closely connected to the teams, not just through the mainstream media, but I would also argue through sites like ours as well, that, you know, we get a lot of feedback from our readers in different states who really say that they feel connected to their team through that. So you were sort of on the cutting edge of it where this was all first starting to take shape, but it certainly wasn't what it is today. And so I just think that's all kind of interesting. We've kind of strayed off the point of, you know, why we would or would not watch the documentary on the Browns leaving. I think for me, to sort of bring this full circle, I just look at it as, yeah, they left. That sucked. It was the worst thing that could have happened as a sports fan to lose a franchise like the Browns. And so I don't necessarily even care anymore why it happened from a behind the scenes standpoint. I don't necessarily care about Bill Belichick as the Browns coach, because that was such a long time ago. And so for me, I just think that I look at it as we've got the issue that we've got today. There's so much to talk about with this year's Browns team that I don't need to look back at what happened in 1995.
Well, and I can respect that. At the same time, I think there's something else that kind of kicks in for me, and that's that from a depression standpoint or whatever you want to call it, when you're dealing with something like losing your football team, it obviously follows the same kind of coping mechanisms that people were dealing with LeBron James and everything like that. And mm-hmm. I would say that, you know, all the people who felt better after, almost better after Miami Heat won the championship this year, they felt like it was their excuse to finally move on and just let it go and say, well, this is stupid. I know mm-hmm. it kind of worked like that for me. But I hit my rock bottom with the Ravens when they won the Super Bowl. And I mean, you can't get any more depressing than that for a Browns fan. So now, I could watch the documentary because I've already seen the bottom of the pit and, you know, I survived that.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison because I do think that you're sort of, I hate to say, coming face to face with your fears, but, you know, watching LeBron James hoisting up that trophy, and like I said when I wrote it at the time, I watched it and I didn't feel anything. It was just, okay, great, you won it, whatever, let's move on. So I can sort of see how this could be viewed kind of the same way when the Ravens did, but I don't know. I didn't watch that Ravens Super Bowl. I couldn't bring myself to watch that game, so I didn't have that maybe that same moment. So maybe I need to watch this documentary. Maybe that'll be my final closure. So maybe you're talking me into it here.
Well, and again, you know, while my distance from the team was a disconnect for that Super Bowl, I'm in Boston and I'm living with Jets and Giants fans and mm-hmm. they all, you know, we all watched that Super Bowl because I was aligned with the Giants fans rooting for the Giants that time. And, you know, so we all, I had people to mourn with over that one.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting. Coming it's weird. Having different reasons, but at the same time, definitely both on the same page on that one.
So yeah, I've got it recording. I'll probably check it out later tonight. And Scott's going to have some kind of a post on it. Obviously, he's going to have to see the whole thing before he... I can't tell you what the gist of it's going to be. But
sure.
It's probably going to be, it was awesome, and it made me want to be a Ravens fan.
Yeah, we'll see about that. Yeah. I'm sure it'll be quite good, though.
So I'm really happy that to get you on, because... honestly, I don't think the word Cavs has been uttered on this podcast since it's been back, other than to say, hey, we didn't talk Cavs today.
Hey, well, that's what I'm good for.
So, obviously, we're in training camp. Everybody's getting ready to go. People are trying to figure out if this team can have the word playoffs next to their name. Obviously, that, you know, it's not like saying playoffs in the NFL because they're eight seeds and usually the eighth seed kind of stinks. Sometimes it doesn't even have a 500 record. So tell me first of all, do you think they can make the playoffs this year? Do you think they should make the playoffs this year? And what kind of has to happen with these young players in order to do that?
Do I think they can? They certainly can. I would not be surprised coming down to the last month of the season for the Cavs to very much be sort of in that, you know, in that running for the final playoff spot. And as far as thinking whether they should, I say why not. And I just go back and I look at the last year LeBron was in Cleveland, and we played that Bulls team in the first round, and that was I believe that was Derrick Rose's second year, maybe it was his third, but I'm pretty sure that was his second year. And you know, the Bulls were the eighth seed, and everybody says, "Oh, well, you don't want to be the eighth seed because you know there's a stigma that that means you're stuck there." That's not always the case. The Thunder were the eight seed a couple years ago as well. So it all depends on your trajectory. If you're a team that is growing and getting better and gaining experience, I think there's value in that. You making the playoffs, getting a taste, getting a little bit of experience when there's nothing to lose. I think that's helpful as well. You know, LeBron and the Cavs never had that, where you kind of get that experience, but you're not expected to win in that first round. You know, when they played the Wizards in that first series, they were the better team and they were favored to win that series. So they never had that climb through the playoffs. And so I think there's a lot of value for teams to go through that. And so I think in terms of Kyrie's development, even the new guys, Waiters and Zeller, I think it can be good for them to make the playoffs. And then going into next offseason, yeah, we're not going to have the high draft picks again, but we've got a ton of cap space at our disposal. And we know Cleveland doesn't tend to sign a lot of free agents, particularly in basketball, but that's not the only way you can use cap space in the NBA. The nice thing about the way the salary cap is structured, they make it so it's a big advantage to have a lot of cap space because you can take on huge contracts that other teams don't want. And then you can say, well, we'll take on some of that cap space and we'll eat some of that money for you, but you're going to have to give us a good player. And so that can sometimes be a tool to get a guy on your team.
Well, and with the new collective bargaining agreement, it does seem like some of these richer teams are going to be a little bit choked.
Sure, definitely.
In terms of that luxury tax and everything.
Yeah, I think you've started to see that happen a little bit already. But right now, while teams are still using their amnesty clause, some of them still have an out. But once they use that amnesty, that's their only out, and then they're forced to trade them. Because again, if you give a guy a guaranteed contract in the NBA, you can't cut him unless he agrees to a buyout. And obviously, players are not usually inclined to do that. So your only way of unloading salary is usually you have to give up an asset, something that somebody wants. So even if Cleveland can't be active in free agency, they'll have some options. However, I would say as well, I don't want to get too encouraged, but I do feel like sort of the stigma around signing with Cleveland is sort of changing a little bit. We've heard some, you know, the rumblings of, well, Andrew Bynum was interested. Obviously, that's not going to happen anymore.
Well, he seems like a really different cat.
Oh, for sure. I mean, he definitely is. And not every free agent is going to say, yeah, I'll listen to Cleveland. But I do think that certain players will listen to Cleveland. I think they will play with Kyrie. I think Kyrie is genuinely liked around the league. I think a lot of guys are really impressed with what he showed as, you know, a 19-year-old rookie coming off playing 11 college games and running away with Rookie of the Year and having the fifth best efficiency rating of all NBA point guards. You look at that and you say, okay, so the Cavs have that. They've got all this cap space. You know, they've got a front office that is in line with the coaching staff, and they all seem to be moving in the same direction. You've got an owner who will open his mouth from time to time. He also spares no expense in making this team comfortable and also making this team incentivized to win. as well. So I think there's a lot of attractive pieces to playing in Cleveland. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, well, it's definitely a prime free agency destination. But I just think that you're hearing things that you didn't used to hear. You're hearing agents say, you know, we wouldn't mind our players get drafted by Cleveland. And, you know, well, maybe our guy will talk to Cleveland. And a perfect example of that is C.J. Miles. Now, C.J. Miles is anything but a superstar. But this was a guy who was a sought-after free agent, and he had options. He had different places he could go, and he chose to come to Cleveland.
Well, and so let's go back to Dan Gilbert for a second, because, you know, that was the big thing when LeBron happened and the letter and all that kind of stuff. And everybody said, well, no free agent is ever going to want to play for Dan Gilbert. It doesn't matter anymore. He's done. But honestly, I think a lot of the players around the NBA probably understand a little bit about what happened there. I think especially as guys like Carmelo and Dwight Howard have piled on and kind of made a mockery of their own situations. I think a lot of guys or almost would understand what Dan Gilbert did. And he doesn't really, unless you're talking about Paul Silas or LeBron James, he hasn't really been all that outlandish in his entire career as an owner.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think that I always thought it was overblown.
It was a big statement when he did open his mouth, but
oh, without a doubt. And I know it rubbed people nationally the wrong way, and I've written this a million times. I understand why.
Did it rub players the wrong way, or just people on Twitter?
Exactly. I don't think players necessarily cared that much. And I think that most players would disagree with the way LeBron left as well. I don't think that move was looked at fondly by a lot of other players. I think that a lot of them looked at that and said, you know, what is this guy doing hosting this ridiculous show for his free agency? and when the details came out that, you know, he didn't even call the Cavs to tell them, I just think that he did a lot of things wrong. LeBron has admitted, you know, he would change sort of some of those circumstances if he could.
Well, and you don't want to use Charlie Villanueva as a benchmark, but even to the point where he was like blowing up details about the party and
right.
He wanted to scoop the whole thing. So obviously he was feeling pretty snide about it.
Exactly. So, you know, and the NBA players are not going to come out and very vocally be anti-LeBron. That's certainly not the case. And for the most part, I think that a lot of NBA players mostly like LeBron. I just think they get turned off by some of the things he does. And I think that the decision was definitely one of the things. I think they would all say, I understand why LeBron left, but I don't think any of them necessarily looked at that whole extravaganza and said, okay, well, that's a classy way to go. Now, that's not to condone Dan Gilbert in their eyes. I just think that they don't necessarily care that much. I think they understood why Gilbert said what he said. And I just don't think they necessarily care that much.
Yeah, even stupid Dwight Howard would hypocritically say that, you know, he never wanted to be LeBron and what LeBron did was wrong. And
yeah, I mean, exactly. And they're all, I don't know. I just think that players have such a different way of looking at the world than you and I do. And certainly, you know, the media, anybody on Twitter, I just think they have a much different way of looking at things. And for them, I just don't think it was that big of a deal one way or the other. I don't think they are applauding what Dan Gilbert wrote. But I've never gotten the impression, I have never heard an agent say, well, my player won't even listen to Cleveland because Dan Gilbert's their owner. I haven't seen that. And Cleveland has been active in pursuing free agents, and their agents are talking to the Cavs. Agents are trying to get their players drafted by the Cavaliers. There were plenty of reports about agents viewing Cleveland in this last year's draft as a prime destination. A lot of guys wanted their players to be drafted by Cleveland to team up with Kyrie. So,
right. And how much of that has to do with Byron Scott, though? Because, you know, he's obviously a coach who came here. He's a former player. He can obviously command attention in the locker room. At some point, though, he's going to have to turn this redevelopment project into something where they're actually making some headway. And obviously, they still have some key rookies with the big draft of Deion Waiters and Zeller. But how much pressure do you think is starting to build up in his camp that he's got to start, you know, doing more?
Right. Well, I was particularly critical of him last year, and I know a lot of our readers didn't like that, my take on that. But I felt like the players sort of gave up on the team a little bit last year. Not everybody agrees with me on that, but I really felt like there was a point going down the stretch where he sort of lost the team, and I wasn't seeing the type of effort you would expect from a Byron Scott team. And it, maybe some of that was partially the players. You know, you had a lot of young players battling injuries and hitting that rookie wall. So I think that was probably certainly part of it as well.
But a roster like that, you also don't expect to kind of get the best of Byron Scott. You expect them to fall in line whenever he says to jump.
Well, you would certainly hope so, but right. That's just not always the case. And if you go back to, there was that, that famous Sports Illustrated poll of players asking what coach would they most like to play for and most not like to play for. And Byron Scott was, I believe, second on the coach they would not like to play for list. Now, some of that is guys who never played for Byron Scott and just hear about, you know, Camp Scott and all the running you have to do and conditioning you have to do in training camp and say, well, I wouldn't want to put up with that. But I think if you ask Kyrie Irving his opinion of Byron Scott, you're going to get a very different answer. So let me just real quickly sort of say, I think that what Byron Scott needs to do this year is put his money where his mouth is and get this team to start playing defense. I don't think this is a particularly talented team on defense. I've said on Twitter that I think this has the potential to be one of the worst defensive teams in the NBA. But if the Cavs are really going to start to make those strides and really get into contention for the playoffs and maybe squeak in as the 8 seed, they're going to have to start to defend at some point. And I really want to see Byron come through with this team on that. I think he's gotten through to them on the pace. The Cavs have been playing at a much better pace in recent years. You can see sort of some of the up-tempo things happening. When it's clicking on offense, you can really see Byron Scott's vision for what this team, what he wants his team to be. You can see that taking shape on offense.
Yeah, it's not Mike Fratello walking back through that door.
Exactly. So you're seeing that, and that's good, and that's encouraging. But this team is atrocious on defense, and part of that is losing Anderson Varejao. I understand that, you know, and he'll be back, and hopefully he can stay healthy this year, knock on wood. But you need to see the rest of the guys start to show some defensive effort, and that comes from coaching. So, looking at this team the last 2 years, there were a lot of players who played under Mike Brown when this was one of the best defensive teams in the league, and you saw good, consistent defensive effort out of guys night in and night out. And when Byron Scott came in, you didn't see that anymore. That those principles fell to the wayside pretty quickly. So it's partially coaching as well. And I really want to see sort of some of that change this year. I want to see that good, consistent night in, night out defensive effort.
And Mike Brown achieved a lot of that when he finally got through to LeBron.
Absolutely.
And LeBron led the rest of the team kind of down the defensive path. So then the question is, obviously, the Cavaliers don't have a LeBron James, but do they have a leader? Is Kyrie Irving going to be capable at his young age of being the one who says, all right, I'm buying into Byron Scott's defense. Now everybody else follow me. We're going to play some D.
I think it has to. You know, Andy is going to give you incredible defensive effort. And so you might say he would be the natural defensive leader. And I do think that this team follows Andy's example on defense. And you saw some of that fall apart when Andy got hurt last year.
Yeah, he's infectious.
Absolutely. When you see that guy playing and giving that much effort, how dare you not follow suit? So I think that's huge. But if you remember LeBron's first two seasons, he was considered a very bad defender. He was routinely written about how poor his defense was.
Yeah, he would show off in the passing lanes, and other than that, he wouldn't man up.
Exactly. So it was one of the biggest criticisms. And he has gone on to become arguably, probably if Dwight is the best defensive player, you could make a strong argument LeBron is the second best defensive player in the NBA.
And he should be, because nobody is bigger and more athletic. Nobody combines those two skill sets like he does.
Right, absolutely. And that's something that Kyrie doesn't have. But Kyrie has to show more effort on defense. And if anybody read, I know Scott posted the headline today about John Hollinger's write-up on the Cavs, and he had a lot of great things to say about Kyrie, but he pointed out in that little blurb how atrocious Kyrie was on defense last year. And so some of that needs to change. I don't need to see Kyrie become a, you know, first team all defense guy this year. But what I want to see is that effort night in and night out. I want to see him really getting up on his man and doing a better effort of slowing him down on that first step. I mean, opposing point guards just, it took no effort to get by him last year. I mean, they so much as raised their eyebrows and they were by him. So I sort of want to see that aspect of it change. I want to see more consistent night in and night out effort. And I'm hopeful that you will, that we will see that. Because again, Kyrie was a rookie last year, coming back from the injuries. There were a lot of circumstances working against him, and he overcame a lot of those to do a lot of great things. Now it's just, are you going to rest on those laurels, or are you going to try and get better? And one of the most glaring ways for him to get better is defense. So that's sort of what I want to see out of Kyrie this year.
All right, and so who's the surprise player for the Cavs? Do they absolutely need Deion Waiters to be a factor in order to be that playoff team? Is it Zeller? Is it Alonzo G? Obviously, Kyrie's got to be there. Obviously, Anderson Varejao's got to be there. Who's the third, mm-hmm. though?
The third, it's got to be Deion Waiters. That pick has to pan out for this rebuilding plan to happen the way the front office envisions it. That guy has to be Deion Waiters, and he doesn't need to be Kyrie Irving. We don't need him to win Rookie of the Year, although it would be nice if he did. But all we need, though, is we need him to step up and show that he can be that third guy. Because Andy's not going to be here forever, obviously. And if Deion is not that guy, we're back to, okay, we have Kyrie Irving and a bunch of nice role players. And I do think that Tyler Zeller is going to be an X factor on this team this year. His ability to run the court is just going to be awesome in this offense and playing the way Byron Scott wants to play. Tyler Zeller is a perfect player for what Byron Scott wants to do. So I'm excited to see that. So you'll see he'll be that X factor. Alonzo gives us some defensive tenacity a little bit of toughness that this team might otherwise lack. But Tristan Thompson, in my opinion, is never going to be, you know, the Robin to Kyrie's Batman. That player has to be Deion Waiters. We need to see that happen. And if that doesn't happen, we're sort of back to the drawing board and trying to figure out where are we going to go from here.
I always kind of considered Tristan Thompson as the guy that we eventually have that argument. Well, shouldn't he be the sixth man? Shouldn't he be the first one off the bench? And I think that's eventually going to be kind of the landing spot for him. I don't know exactly why. I've just always had that feeling about him.
Well, I think that this would be an excellent team if you're saying Tristan is coming off the bench. The problem I have is that he's going to be starting for Cleveland. I don't have any doubt about that, that I think he's going to be starting for the Cavaliers this year.
From the start,
and
yeah.
I think that sort of shows, an area that this team might be lacking. And I hate to be so harsh on Tristan because I like him a lot and I really, really want him to pan out, obviously, but he has some glaring holes in his game. And what we saw in the summer league did not encourage me that he's made a lot of progress in those areas. So I think that's a little bit of a concern, but, it all comes back to, you know, we started this talking about whether they are going to make the playoffs and whether they should make the playoffs. And that's going to be a conversation. I think that's going to be ongoing all year. I think we're all going to be looking at it and saying, well, what's best for the rebuilding process. And I mean, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that they should make the playoffs, or do you think that going for another year of draft picks is a better way to go?
I never agree with going for draft picks. I think you fall where you fall at all times. I think you play as hard as you can. You be as good as you can. Because anything less, I think the players see through it, and I think you really stunt your growth and development, and you create a bad culture. And I'm not sure that even the best draft picks all piled on top of each other can overcome that kind of a culture. So I think you always get to where you get to where you belong. And mm-hmm. for the Cavs last year, that was 21 wins. That projects out that would have been 26 wins in a regular schedule. And that's what they deserved. I don't want to talk about more ping pong balls. I don't want to talk about draft lottery. the Cavs will get the pick they're supposed to get. They weren't supposed to get the number one pick and get Kyrie Irving. So things happen. It's a lot of luck. It's a lot of bad luck. You just, you gotta play it the best you can, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think you hit it on the head perfectly. We're talking about that culture. And that's the thing that I've always been a big believer in. I think that winning is contagious and so is losing. And you look at what happened, what's going on with the Browns. You know, we've changed quarterbacks, we've changed coaches, coordinators, GMs, presidents, wide receivers, and now we're changing owners. But the one thing that's never changed is this losing culture. And you look at other teams, what is it about the Steelers? What is it about the Patriots that, you know, these teams can just plug these guys in and it works out? And I think a lot of that is the culture. When you learn how to win, these guys pass it on to the new blood when they come in. But when you learn how to lose, that can get passed on as well. And I'm with you on that 100%. I don't want the Cavs to continuously say, all right, you know, we're playing for the lottery. I don't want that mindset around here. I want to see this team start to take their upward trajectory. I am perfectly comfortable, like I said, with us, you know, being the 8 seed. And then going into the offseason, see what you can swing. And you know what? If they don't do anything, they'll get worse. And then, you know, we'll be back in the lottery again. But, you know, I just think it's all about finding that upward trajectory, learning how to win, and sort of changing the culture again. That's sort of a big thing for me.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing. You know, if you really want to talk about it, if you're a proponent of draft and ping pong balls, the Cavs got lucky last year because Varejao got hurt. And so it's like so much of this stuff is just kind of out of your control that to sit there and pretend that you could try not to win and somehow come out the other end as a good team. It just seems astonishing to me that anybody would. It's like you're trying to be too smart for the universe.
Yeah, and I would argue that it came back to bite the Cavs a little bit that, you know, again, you question, I mean, they got the draft pick they deserved, sure, but you looked at in what was arguably a three-player top-heavy draft, we got pick number 4. So that whole mentality sort of came back to bite us a little bit, I thought anyways. I just think that it's a backwards way of looking at development. I don't know. I can understand why last year people were arguing for it, but I've always been firmly in the let's just go ahead and try and win. Let's try and build some confidence and build some positive experience.
When, and it's not even the philosophy. It was the attitude of the people who were promoting that philosophy, I think, too, who they're, you're so stupid if you're happy about winning, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's not a
shut up and go short some stocks or something. I mean, yeah. Bet against the house on the craps table.
Exactly. So.
All right. Well, we just hit the half hour mark, and I know, right? And I like to keep these things certainly under an hour. But I think we should spend the next 10. I think we should do probably 10 more minutes, and we should talk a little bit about the Browns game against the Giants because obviously the Browns have 10 days to prepare for this one. They're banged up in the receiving core. I don't even know if that matters because the receiving core has been kind of bad anyway. This team has been really, really close. For all the criticism I've given them and their coaching and their kind of lazy attitude of the preseason and not using it to its most effect, they have been really close in pretty much every game. And maybe they're finally poised. The Giants are banged up. Two of their – not Victor Cruz, but the other two top wide receivers are going to be out for this game, it seems like. So – is this an opportunity where the Browns are going to shock the world? Does Pat Shurmur have one of these signature wins in him like Eric Mangini had?
I don't know about that.
Did he have a signature win last year at all? I don't think he did.
I would definitely say not. And I don't know. You could sort of see where it would make sense for a coach like Mangini to have that sort of a signature win in such a bad season. I don't know if Shurmur is that kind of coach. I'm not necessarily that high on Pat Shurmur and the job he's been doing, but to look at this matchup, I think that it is prime for an upset. You certainly nailed it there. The elements of what you would look for are certainly there. But I just don't know if this team is quite ready to beat the Giants yet. But I just think it's funny because the game that they were the closest to winning was the Eagles game. And that was probably the game I was most disheartened with. I actually was completely just devastated by the way the team looked in that game. Obviously the defense played great, but just in general, I just felt like, man, nothing has changed. But I do think, over these last couple games, we've seen the Browns for the first time in quite a while look like an actual NFL team. They're losing the way NFL teams lose, not the way the Cleveland Browns lose, which I've always felt like the Browns for the past several years would lose in ways that no other teams would lose. They would just look just bad on such a different scale from everybody else. And so what I think we're starting to see is things starting to come together a little bit. You see Trent Richardson and you know that this guy is the real deal. Brandon Whedon has shown me a lot to be encouraged by. Certainly, going into Baltimore on a Thursday night game, your first nationally televised game, the weather wasn't great, and he played his heart out. He played a solid game, and his receivers really let him down.
Excuse me, Pat Shurmur would say he battled.
He battled. And so there's a lot of encouragement in the direction they're going, but I don't know is that I would say that they're quite ready to beat the Giants yet. But I don't know. I mean, what do you think about sort of the way this team plays for Pat Shurmur?
Well, overall, I haven't been, you know, I was the one who was kind of saying Pat Shurmur hasn't been good in his rookie year. There were a lot of extenuating circumstances that they won't use as excuses, but that doesn't mean that I shouldn't. And I was really looking for, you know, what Holmgren called that big jump this year, and I was looking for that in the coaching as well, because he finally had the offensive coordinator. He finally had the quarterback he seemingly wanted. He finally had the running back that should be the game changer. And again, it just feels like he's kind of eking around the game plan. It doesn't feel like he's decisive enough. I will still go on record arguing with anybody about that 2-point conversion. I think we'll just drop that one so that you and I don't get off on it.
Yeah, otherwise we'll be here another half hour.
But overall, I haven't, and I said going into this season that I was going to give Shurmur until the bye week, kind of look for it as we get towards the second half of the season before I was going to make a judgment. And I'll hold to that, but so far not so good.
Yeah. You look at the way teams play, and I think you can tell the signs of a well-coached team. Even if a team isn't always necessarily winning, you could say, but man, that's a well-coached team. And not everybody is going to be a Belichick or a Harbaugh or something like that, but I just look at the way the discipline with which those teams play, the consistency that they give. You watch the 49ers play. That is a well-coached football team. I watch, the Houston Texans play. That looks like a well-coached football team to me. When I watch the Browns play, I don't see what I would consider a well-coached football team. And there's silly mistakes. Clock management issues, there's from play calling issues, from the flow of the game. I just think there's a lot of issues that I look at that I can't sit here and tell you, man, the Browns look like a well-coached team. They just don't have talent. I would agree that they don't have the talent that other teams have, but I think that they also don't have the talent in the coaching side as well.
Well, and you know, this is kind of something that I've been thinking about. I haven't written about it. I've been kind of developing it in my own head, but I think that a lot of the time we know whether the coach is going to be acceptable or not, even before he coaches his first game. And I know that sounds unfair or maybe even a little bit crazy, but you know, there's a lot of research behind the fact that your first instinct, your first judgment is usually most correct. And now after 2 years or 1.5 years of listening to Pat Shurmur talk to the media and do post-game press conferences and answer questions, does he seem like a guy who is capable of thinking on his feet and out-scheming another NFL coach?
Yeah, like I don't think when you hear him speak, he doesn't speak like a guy that you're like, that's who I want to go to war with. There's that hesitation in him. And you don't want to see that in a coach. A coach should be decisive. A coach should know his game plan, should know his philosophy. It should be so ingrained in him that he doesn't have to think to answer a question about it.
And 10 times a season, you should get a look at him on the sideline where it looks like, oh my gosh, I have the greatest idea in the world. And we never get that.
Exactly. And it's been so lacking in Pat Shurmur. And, you know, I think you're right. I think, you know, that first impression does tell you a lot. And I look at, you know, when Ohio State hired Jim Tressel, I didn't know who Jim Tressel was, and I was not happy with the hire. I thought, man, we really took a step backwards hiring this guy who has, you know, he's coming from a lower division. How is this guy possibly going to handle the magnitude of this job? And then I watched his opening press conference, and I was riveted. And he was decisive. He knew exactly what he wanted out of Ohio State. He knew how we were going to play, how we were going to act, how we were going to represent the state, the school, and how we were going to play against Michigan, all of these things. And there was no hesitation, no pensiveness, no, you know, he wasn't worried about anything. You could just sense the confidence. And I wanted to go play for Jim Tressel. And when I watch Pat Shurmur talk, I sit there and I just say, this guy isn't sure of what he's doing. The job seems too big for him. And that was our criticism last year of him. And I think we all kind of were hoping, well, okay, you know, this year he has an off season to get comfortable. He's brought in an offensive coordinator to help shoulder off some of that load. So now he can be a little bit more comfortable in his own skin. And I don't know. I mean, do you think he looks more comfortable? I don't necessarily see it. He says he is. But I don't necessarily see it.
Well, and that's the only other thing is that I wrote that article. I said he looked like a totally different guy. He sounded like a totally different guy. And that was before the ownership change happened. And then he kind of slunk, you know, slinked right back into that old nastiness.
Yeah, maybe that rattled him a little bit. You know, I think it probably, I mean, of course it did, I guess. The results have not been great, obviously. And when somebody spends $1 billion on something, they want to see some results. And so for Pat Shurmur to think that his job was even remotely safe would be foolish. And he has to understand that. And I'm sure he does. So I think maybe that's a big thing is, maybe you're right. Maybe prior to this going down, he was starting to feel comfortable. He knew his role. He was comfortable with Mike Holmgren. You know, he was comfortable with his coaching staff, and he felt sure that he was going down the right path. But then you have the ownership change, and it's like, well, you know, Mike Holmgren's most likely going to be gone. Once Mike Holmgren's gone, that's my security blanket there. Right. That's my guy. That's my guy. That's going to. Yeah. That's the guy that's going to go to battle for me.
And he welcomed all these coordinators and all these different people who all now look like really primed interim coaches. But I would take it back and I won't speak for you because I don't know if you've ever worked in one of these large corporations, but I worked in a huge corporation, and you could always see a guy who was promoted all the way up, promoted all the way up to like VP. And then he just kind of looked unpromotable in that position. And that's the feeling I get from Pat Shurmur. He's never going to be capable of being the president of a division. He's going to sit at that VP level, and he's going to be trusted, and he's going to be a great coach, but he was never capable of running the whole show. And it seems like he was promoted beyond his level. It was the same. Well, I was going to say it was the same as Romeo Crennel, but Crennel is a different story altogether.
Well, but you know what though, it just sort of fits the line. You look at these head coaches that we've had since the Browns have been back. Chris Palmer, do you know where he is at right now?
I want to say Tennessee or something like that.
Yeah, like I feel like maybe one time I heard him mentioned as a guy who interviewed for another head coaching job, but that guy never sniffed another head coaching job. Butch Davis will never sniff another head coaching job in the NFL. Romeo Crennel is on his second job, but I think already you're seeing in Kansas City a lot of the same issues that he had in Cleveland. Will Eric Mangini coach again in the NFL? I don't know. That's an interesting question. But And I think it'll be a while before if Pat Shurmur does indeed, I hate to even talk about this right now. We're in week five, but if he doesn't survive, I don't know is that I see Pat Shurmur as a guy that's going to have another head coaching job anytime soon in the NFL. So it sort of fits this sequence of coaches that the Browns have hired. Like, they haven't gone out and just hired a solid NFL head coach. Even if this is a guy who's had even, I don't know, sort of waning success here and there, but just all of their hires, I feel like, maybe with the exception of Mangini, I guess Mangini was a little bit different because he had coached in the playoffs before, but certainly all the rest of the coaches, like, this was all their first taste. Like, it's all been new to them. It's always new. We just can't seem to get a guy who's just sort of established as a coach. So,
well, and even when the guy passes the smell test, it's not always the right thing. Like, when mm-hmm. San Francisco promoted Singletary, I was like, good idea. Give him a shot. It doesn't always, even when you think it's a good idea, it doesn't always work.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's certainly right. But I think everybody understood why they did that. And I think that you can't argue with why they hired Singletary, and you know, they took their shot with it, but I don't know.
But the problem is, I think most people were looking at the Pat Shurmur hire and going, well, I think that's a bad idea. And even I went back and looked, because we've been accused of being kind of patsies for the Browns organization. Yeah. Probably because of the tone of my stuff. I'm always trying to be so hopeful because I'm a fan. Well, I want to be hopeful.
Right.
But I went back and looked, and all our coverage on Pat Shurmur after he was hired was like, well, maybe he won't stink.
that's so Cleveland too. I just love it. It's like, you know, all these other guys have stunk. So maybe this will be the guy who doesn't stink.
Well, and that's exactly what you said. You said he's off to a bad start, but he's not in bad company, because everybody else who's ever been here was off to a bad start too.
Yeah, exactly.
That was your way of giving him the benefit of the doubt, going, hey, he smells like poop, but so did everybody else.
Exactly. He's no different. He's a Cleveland Browns head coach.
And because it's family friendly, I said poop.
That's right.
And with that, we are okay. Over the 45-minute mark.
Well, real quick though, let me just get your take on the Giants game then. Two years ago, you know, when the last time we played the Giants when they were coming off the Super Bowl, we did shock the world. And, you know, I was at that Monday night game, and
Braylon Edwards did Guitar Hero. Yeah.
Oh man. I told one of my friends today, I said, man, that was the best Browns game I've ever been to. And then I kind of stopped and I said, well, wait, I guess that's not really saying much, because I honestly think I've only seen the Browns win three games since they've been back. So it's maybe not saying much. But anyways, but they did. They showed a lot of heart in that game coming out, and they took it to the Giants. So now here we are. Giants are coming off that, you know, they're defending Super Bowl champs. And as you said earlier, all these pieces are in place that could smell upset. So, I mean, what's your take on it?
My take is that if the game was at home, the Browns would have a 47.2% chance of winning. And mm-hmm. because it's on the road, that drops 10 points to 37.2% chance.
All right, I can buy that. I can buy that.
So there's better than 1 in 4 chance that the Browns shock the world and win this game. But to predict a victory, you just have to be crazy.
Yeah, I just don't think the team is quite there yet. And you know, I think once Joe Hayden comes back, it's going to make a huge difference for this team. I really do. I think that you've really noticed the defense has really missed him. And so I think when he comes back, it'll be another week of experience for the team. I think as, you know, Brandon Whedon settles down and if hopefully at some point we can just have a game where a receiver gives us an effort, yeah, maybe we'll win a game.
I'm expecting one week where Brandon Whedon gets like Derek Anderson hot, where he's hitting all those deep balls and they just explode for 35 points from the offense, plus maybe a couple of field goals and drop a 41 on the board, you know?
Yeah, I think the talent is there. I think the talent to do that is there. And
just not consistently.
It's just not consistent. We haven't had that one game where everybody's on at the same time. And, you know, you play the law of averages, I guess. You hope at some point that'll happen and the Browns will win a game.
Well, hope. That's it.
That's right. Hope.
Well, and I want to thank Andrew from the Subway Fresh Take hotline, and I'll be expecting my check, my Jared Fogle check, and maybe we can finally get paid.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Well, that's it for Andrew. This is Craig, and this has been the WaitingForNextYear.com podcast.